Greetings and polyphonic libations, my vitreously leukocellular listeners, and welcome to this May 2016 Science News Update. I'm your host for this insignificantly noteworthy science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Since you guys, my beloved listeners, have been bugging me for months to go to a doctor for sleep apnea, I'm half tempted to tell you my adventures in the realms of sleep apnea diagnosis and treatment. Although it would take a really long time. Maybe I'll do this in two parts. We'll do diagnosis this month. Yeah, that's a good idea. I went to a pulmonary specialist a couple of months ago to be tested for sleep apnea. For first-time listeners, I have been accused by my lovely wife of ceasing to breathe while snoring very heavily. That is probably the most common accompaniment to sleep apnea. So after waiting 2 months to see a specialist, I guess he's very busy since he couldn't fit me in for quite a while, I finally sat down with this well-known doctor. After interviewing me on my sleeping habits, lack of daytime energy, and general exhaustion, the good doctor says, "Yes, I am pretty sure that you have sleep apnea, but we must do a sleep study to be sure." And no, that is not at all what my doctor sounded like, but I thought I'd give him a classy German accent for entertainment purposes. Anyway, what the doctor said translated to, "Yeah, it sure sounds like you have sleep apnea, and that's good enough for me, but the insurance company won't pay one thin dime unless we prove it to them clinically." They then set me up with the apparatus needed to do the sleep study, or the polysomnogram, or PSG. The apparatus performs general monitoring of sleep and a variety of bodily functions during sleep, including breathing pattern, oxygen level in the blood, heart rhythms, and limb movement. It consists of two breathing tubes stuck up your nose, and these are attached to the brainwave monitor, which is literally glued to your forehead for the evening so it won't come off. An alarm goes off if the breathing tubes are dislodged from your nose, waking you up. An alarm goes off if the electrodes glued to your forehead are dislodged, waking you up. An alarm goes off if the whole thing is dislodged, waking you up. Ugh, a truly restful experience for something that's supposed to be measuring your sleep. Even given the Torquemada level of torture that this device inflicted on me, I was able to sleep for 3 hours the evening that I slipped this little gem atop my noggin. Finally, when I awoke again at 1:45 a.m., there was no way on God's green earth I was getting back to sleep with that thing stuck to my head. Thinking I had to have the bloody device attached to me for at least 6 hours or it would invalidate the test, I spent the rest of the sleepless night catching up on my TV watching with The Flash and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. When, bleary-eyed, I returned the device the next morning, I'd lightly joked with the nurse how uncomfortable the device was, and I wondered how many people ever complained about it. She looked at me blandly, no humor at all in her face or eyes, and told me that almost no one ever complained that it was uncomfortable. She then glared at me as if she had designed the apparatus herself and was personally insulted by my even intimating that it might have any level of discomfort. I slunk on out of there and returned a week later to be told by my doctor that I had severe sleep apnea. Not as bad as some, as he said, but bad enough. Yippee-ki-yay. I asked him if I had slept enough with his torture device on my head, and he told me, "Oh yeah, plenty." I guess I could have taken it off after 3 hours of sleep and actually gotten some real sleep after that. I just wish somebody had told me that. We'll continue this next month. Join us for part two, The Horrors of CPAP. So here's the first actual news of the night. Limb regeneration may soon be a reality in humans. As most of you know, there are some animals on the evolutionary tree that have the ability to replace legs and tails if they're cut off. They can regenerate them, much as the fictional Wolverine or Deadpool can in the Marvel Comics and movie universe. In the real world, it seems that salamanders and zebrafish are especially good at doing this. They can repair injured hearts and spinal cords and even regrow lost limbs. because they possess certain genes. And for a long time, geneticists believed it was just, well, the luck of the evolutionary draw for these animals, and that they had genetic systems that those of us a bit higher up on the evolutionary scale just lack. As it happens, it was discovered several years back that there are indeed human counterparts to the regeneration genes in those animals. So the mystery deepened. If humans have tissue-regenerating genes too, then why are our tissue regeneration capabilities so limited? The answer, it turns out, may have less to do with the genes themselves than it has to do, well, how the genes are regulated, turned on and turned off. According to Dr. Keith Poss of Duke University, what we're missing are gene regulatory elements that can engage our neglected tissue regeneration machinery. Additionally, he says that these gene regulatory elements could be installed by means of genetic engineering. Poss's group just published their findings in April in the journal Nature in an article entitled "Modulation of Tissue Repair by Regeneration Enhancer Elements." Poss says that they first looked for genes that were strongly induced during fin and heart regeneration in zebrafish. This analysis suggested that a gene called leptin B was especially important in tissue regeneration. His group then scoured the surrounding area of the genome on the DNA for enhancer elements. Now, an enhancer element is a sequence that's sort of the genetic equivalent of an amplifier on a PA system. Poss figured that if the gene was found in both humans and zebrafish, then the fish must have the ability to turn up or amplify the expression of the gene, which, well, humans can't do. Ultimately, they were actually successful. Poss's group found a series of enhancer elements, which they called tissue regeneration enhancer elements, or TREESs, trees. These tree enhancer sequences appear to trigger gene expression, and they can also be engineered to modulate the regenerative potential of vertebrate organs. Poss says in the article, quote, "Simple enhancer effector transgenes employing leptin B linked sequences upstream of a pro or anti-regenerative factor controlled the efficacy of regeneration in zebrafish. This element could activate expression in injured neonatal mouse tissues and was divisible into tissue-specific modules sufficient for expression in regenerating zebrafish fins or hearts," unquote. In the process of analyzing the tree enhancer sequences, Poss discovered that the element could be separated into two distinct parts, one that activates genes in an injured heart, for example, and then next to it, another that activates genes in an injured fin in the fish. In a move that would have made Dr. Frankenstein blush, Poss then fused those two tree sequences to upregulate two regeneration genes in zebrafish that were not present previously. He attached them to the fibroblast growth factor and neuregulin 1 genes, thus creating the fish equivalent of Wolverine, a transgenic zebrafish whose fins and heart had superior regenerative responses after injury. Finally, in true mad scientist fashion, Poss decided to try out his new magic tree sequences on a mammalian system in transgenic mice. Okay, he wasn't quite that mad. All he did was attach the tree enhancer to a gene called LacZ. LacZ produces blue color whenever it's turned on. Remarkably, the tree sequence, which was borrowed from the genome of zebrafish, was able to activate gene expression in injured paws and hearts of transgenic mice. No, it did not induce repair of those injuries, yet, but it did turn on when the mice were injured. So we're halfway there. Poss said in an interview, quote, "We are just at the beginning of this work, but now we have an encouraging proof of concept that these elements possess all the sequences necessary to work with mammalian machinery after injury," unquote. Next story. The human genome is a strange place. In a recent piece of research that came out in March from Dr. Julia Wildschut's lab in the journal The Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, it was reported that more than 8% of the human genome comes from retroviruses that infected our ancestors' germ cells. While most of these ancient viruses can no longer replicate or infect others, Wild Shoot has now found one that actually may be functional. Just to put this in perspective, since many of you are thinking 8%, big deal, the amount of the human genome that actually codes for protein and is actual genes is about 5%. So there is more ancient viral DNA in our genome than actual coding sequence that makes us human. It makes you think about what actually makes a genome human, or palm tree, or agouti for that matter. At any rate, where did these things come from? When a retrovirus enters a cell and inserts a copy of its RNA genome, which it converted into DNA, into the host cell's DNA. On occasion, retroviruses infect cells contributing to the germline, resulting in their transmission to offspring as what are called endogenous retroviruses, or ERVs. Over the course of evolution, this has happened so many times that, well, more than 8% of the human genome originated from retroviruses. Wildschut and her group analyzed more than 2,500 sequenced genomes from the 1,000 Genomes Project and the Human Genome Diversity Project with an improved algorithm they developed to seek out and find these viral sequences. They confirmed the presence of 17 known ERVs and discovered 19 new ones. Most of the human ERVs have been traveling in the human genome for so long that they're filled with mutations and deletions or recombination events in one or more of their necessary elements. They can no longer express genes or copy themselves or move around or do really much of anything. And we're probably lucky about this. Wildschut's team focused on one group of human ERVs introduced to the genome only about 2 million years ago. Because of their relatively young age, viral RNA, protein, and even non-infectious retrovirus-like particles have shown up in tumors and placentas over time. Among the 19 new HERVs of this class, her group identified three that were still flanked by what are called long terminal repeats. These are special repeats at either end of the viral genome that allow it to become part of the human genome and move around and stick in one place or another. In other words, it gives it the ability to move. One of these viral sequences even carried all of the genes needed for a viral function and lacked mutations or substitutions in sequences that were absolutely needed. Wildschut said, quote, "This one looks like it's capable of making infectious viruses, which would be very exciting if true, as it would allow us to study a viral epidemic that took place a long time ago. This is a thrilling discovery. It will open up many doors of research." Frankly, it sounds like a scary scenario to me, one out of a bad science fiction horror novel, but that's just me. You have to wonder about scientists sometimes. They are very strange people. Next story. I've talked about fructose being a problem in the human diet previously, but a new report out of UCLA in the journal eBiomedicine entitled "Systems Nutrigenomics Reveals Brain Gene Networks Linking Metabolic and Brain Disorders" suggests that fructose in your diet may be even worse for you than we thought previously. It seems that fructose can reprogram the epigenome of the brain, changing the expression of hundreds of genes, including genes that may lead to a greater predisposition toward metabolic diseases like diabetes, and brain disorders like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. The article describes how fructose promotes these genetic changes, these epigenetic changes, in the brain, which begin with DNA methylation changes in the BGN and FMOD genes. These are both genes that make extracellular matrix proteins. In addition, gene networks are altered that govern cell metabolism, cell communication, inflammation, and neuronal signaling. But all is not lost. Another component of your diet can reverse this horror. Dr. Jia Yang, the main author of the study, said, quote, "We further demonstrate that an omega-3 fatty acid, DHA, reverses the genomic and network perturbations elicited by fructose, providing molecular support for nutritional interventions to counteract diet-induced metabolic and brain disorders," unquote. To test the effects of fructose and DHA, Yang trained rats to escape from a maze and then randomly divided animals into three groups. And for the next 6 weeks, one group of rats drank water with fructose that would be roughly equivalent to a person drinking about a liter of soda a day. The second group was given fructose water and a rich diet of DHA. And the third group received water without fructose and no DHA. After 6 weeks, the rats were put through the maze again. The animals that had been given only the fructose navigated the maze about half as fast as the rats that drank only water, indicating that the fructose diet had impaired their memory. The rats that had been given fructose and DHA, however, showed very similar results to those that only drank water. This finding strongly suggests that the DHA eliminated fructose's harmful effects. Other tests on the rats revealed more major differences. The rats receiving a high fructose diet had a much higher blood glucose level, triglyceride levels, and insulin levels than the other two groups. Those results are significant because in humans, elevated glucose and triglycerides and insulin are linked to diabetes and obesity and other diseases. So, what's the implication of all this? Well, first, don't drink Coca-Cola unless it's the stuff from Mexico that's made of cane sugar and has no fructose. Second, well, your mom was right. Cod liver oil, which is a big source of DHA, is good for you. Horrible as it tastes. If you're going to drink mainstream soft drinks with lots of fructose, at least imbibe in fish oil as well. This whole study falls into a new category of research called nutrigenomics, in which scientists study the relationship between diet and our genome. Yang says, quote, "Most people don't realize it, but food is like a pharmaceutical compound that affects the brain. Based on our data, I recommend avoiding sugary soft drinks and cutting down on desserts and generally consuming less sugar and saturated fat." Unquote. Next story. This next story I read in the Journal of the Scientist. It harkens back to not just science in the 19th century when scientists used themselves or their relatives as guinea pigs. It also reminded me of the initial plot of many very bad horror movies, where a new medical treatment is quite promising before it turns, well, dreadfully horrendous. Actually, lots of Doctor Who episodes start that way. So, last year, Dr. Elizabeth Parrish, the CEO of Seattle-based biotech firm BioViva, hopped a plane to Colombia, where she received multiple injections of two experimental gene therapies her company had developed. Notice, she went to Colombia because it's illegal to do something as stupid and dangerous as that in the United States. But I digress. One of her injections was intended to lengthen the caps of her chromosomes. These are called telomeres, and telomeres are there to protect the ends of chromosomes as cells replicate and chromosomes are copied. The other injection was aimed to increase muscle mass. Parrish told the journal, quote, "The idea was that together these treatments would compress mortality by staving off the diseases of aging, enabling people to live healthier and longer," unquote. On the BioViva website on April 22nd, a few weeks back, BioViva reported the first results of Parrish's treatment. The telomeres of her leukocytes grew longer, from 6,700 base pairs in September 2015 to 7,300 base pairs in March 2016. So the question now is, what does that mean? Does it mean anything at all? The company crowed Parrish's genetic response as success against human aging, having, quote, reversed 20 years of normal telomere shortening. My response is, yeah, right, sure, come back to me in 20 years and tell me this. Part of my problem with this is the idea that human aging is governed by shortening of telomeres. That's a great theory. It's very controversial. As we age, the ends of our chromosomes shorten more and more as our cells undergo replication. Some people say this causes aging. Other people say that it's just an effect of aging and is not a cause. If shortening telomeres are like gray hair, then, well, dyeing your hair is not going to make you live longer. Additionally, there are lots of animals whose telomeres shorten more slowly than they do in humans, including fruit flies. But we outlive most of those animals by decades. This suggests that longer telomeres do not bring about longer lives. Paris says, quote, "The best scenario would be that we added 20 years of health onto the leukocytes, and my immune system might be more productive and catch more of the bad guys. But we have to wait and find out. The proof will be in the data," unquote. Ah, yes. Spoken like a true mad scientist, whose data has still not undergone peer review, even though she's told everybody about it. The other gene therapy that Parrish received, the gene encoding follistatin protein, well, that one is at least supported by human data. In the context of people with muscle disorders, there's no data demonstrating the effects of follistatin therapy on age-related muscle loss. Follistatin inhibits another protein called myostatin. Myostatin puts the brakes on muscle growth and therefore makes it attractive for muscular dystrophy treatment. Early clinical trials on 6 people with Becker's muscular dystrophy, for example, showed that 4 of them could actually walk longer distances after follistatin gene therapy in their muscles. Paris said in the article that she expects MRI data on her muscles' response to the treatment in about a month. She is now traveling the globe to find a regulatory partner willing to approve human clinical trials on a large scale. She says, quote, "When I started looking into this, it seemed like a crazy science. But it's a crazy science whose time had come," unquote. Frankly, I think she's just crazy. Ask Dr. Jekyll if he thought self-experimentation was a good idea in the long run. Anyway. Next, quick story, and this is hardly science. Oprah Winfrey will star in an upcoming HBO film based on Rebecca Skloot's book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Variety reported on May 2nd that in addition to producing the film, Oprah will play the role of Deborah Lacks, daughter of Henrietta Lacks, whose cells were harvested and used without her permission and have played an essential role in medical research. Henrietta Lacks died way back in 1951, but her cancerous cells, dubbed HeLa cells, form the basis of an immortal cell line that have helped lay the foundation for a polio vaccine, as well as for some cancer and HIV research. The book and film tells the story of Lacks and her family, whose contributions went unrecognized for decades, in part to protect privacy. Most scientists, including me, never even knew Henrietta Lacks' name. For years, when I talked about HeLa cells in a biology class, I would refer to the donor as Helen Lane, as many textbooks suggested her name was. Next short story. How many bacterial species are there in the world? Any idea? If someone asked me, I would probably say, oh, millions, for sure. And I'd be pretty confident in my answer. Well, I'm not even close. Heck, I'm not even close to what has already been cataloged. Researchers led by Jane Lennon at Indiana University have combined scaling laws with a model of biodiversity to produce a new estimate of the number of microbial species on Earth. And that seems to be somewhere between 10 to the 11th and 10 to the 12th species. Translated into the common speech, that is between 100 billion and 1 trillion. Given the current number of cataloged species, which actually stands at around 10 million, the researchers predict that around, 99.999% of microbial species are still left to discover. Their findings were published in the May issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Lennon said, quote, "Estimating the number of species on Earth is among the great challenges in biology. Our study combines the largest available data sets with ecological models and new ecological rules for how biodiversity relates to abundance. This gave us a new and rigorous estimate for the number of microbial species on Earth," unquote. Lennon's study compiled data from 20,376 surveys of bacteria, archaeobacteria, and microscopic fungi, plus 14,862 sampling efforts on trees, birds, and mammals from 35,000 different locations in the world. After demonstrating that the abundance of the most dominant ocean bacterial species scales with the total number of individuals across 30 orders of magnitude, the researchers used these data to predict the existence of about 1 trillion microbial species worldwide. Alrighty then, last story of the night. And as in previous podcasts, we traditionally save the titillating story of the night for last. So what's the big headline? Well, males affect the physiology of females. What? Of course they do. Didn't anybody ever explain the birds and the bees to these researchers? Sorry, bear with me. Okay, what they actually meant was something a little bit different. A new study shows that the presence of males increases weight and stress in females, regardless of reproductive status. What? Okay, I'm not taking the blame for this. This is directed at my wife. You were a lot less stressed with just me around than before the kids. So let's not go slinging blame here. At any rate, Dr. Michael Garrett of the University of New South Wales says that, quote, having a mate comes with a host of biological benefits beyond having offspring, and yet there are some drawbacks. For a better understanding of the biological effects of sexual conflict and parental investment, we are teasing apart which effects are due to partner interactions and which are due to offspring production. Unquote. His group's studies on this topic were published in March in the journal Science Reports. To test whether similar effects were seen in animals, Garrett paired female mice with vasectomized, castrated, or healthy males, or other females, and then measured their weight, stress levels, oxidative stress, and energy metabolism. Garrett said, quote, when you give a male a vasectomy, they don't produce any sperm, but they still produce high levels of androgen and produce seminal fluid. So you can look for differences between females who have mated with vasectomized males and those who have mated with intact males. And castrated males lose their interest in mating almost altogether, so you can be pretty sure these males aren't mating with the females, or at least mating at much lower levels, and so see what might be resulting from these interactions. Unquote. He found that simply being paired with a male, any male, increased the weight of the female, no matter whether that male was whole, vasectomized, or castrated. They also found that the females had increased levels of corticosterone, suggesting higher stress levels, with those housed with a castrated male showing the highest level of stress hormone. Wait, major stress with a eunuch around? I would think that would relax females. But, okay, what do I know? At any rate, there were no significant changes to oxidative stress in any of the pairings. Garrett says he was somewhat surprised by the results, but said they fit well with previous studies done in fruit flies. Quote, our results indicate that the different aspects of interactions with males have differential effects on females, which could be associated with the costs and benefits of mating. We are planning further experiments using this model to see how long these changes might persist and how they might affect reproduction later in life, unquote. Yeah, right, as if wives don't have enough to blame husbands about. Do we really need stress and weight gain thrown in as well? Seriously, Garrett, give us a break here. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Remember to watch Oprah in her new Gila Cell movie. If you do a sleep study, remember that the torture does not need to be the whole night. Don't do genetic experiments on yourself, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.